Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I am Ted Santos, and I am your host of The Creative Alchemist. And we come to you live every Thursday from 7 until 8, and it's Thursday at 7 o'clock. And we talk to you about business, whether it's your business, the company you work for, the company you would like to start. And we cover many topics. We've had some very interesting and capable guests. All of our shows have a guest. They are experts in specific areas, and we open up the phone line so that you can talk to them and address or ask questions, some of your toughest questions dealing with business. And we've looked at things like leadership and project management and finance, accounting, planning for this new year, or the reset that some people call COVID. And tonight, well, we're going to be talking about having people in your organization that you want to motivate. And we're going to look at it from a very unique perspective. We're going to sort of step outside of business and look at inspiring and motivating people in general, getting innovation, getting people to think in ways they have never thought before. And so you see, how can you engage people in their dreams? And that is sort of the subject matter where we're coming. And Stephen, you're with us tonight. You're our guest, so thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
No, it's our pleasure. So how about you tell people a little bit about yourself, what you do? You have a very interesting background. And for anyone who thinks he's a teenager, he's not. He's got a very young voice, and trust me, he has been around a block more than once. So not that he's an old guy, but he's youthful.
Sure. So I'll start with the short story, because I think we may delve deeper later. But so currently I am a tenured associate professor of interior architecture at Marywood University in Scranton, Pennsylvania. And yes, it is an actual real place. It's not just the home of the office. We do live there. So, I've been teaching for the past 20 years. My background is in fine arts, studio arts, and art history. But I've been teaching since 2009. I found myself teaching in the School of Architecture. So I teach foundation design to architects and interior architects. I go into history. I do furniture design. I do a little bit of everything. So yeah, like Ted just mentioned, I've done a lot of different things in the time that I've been, I would say, active. And I think that's one of the things that sort of connected me with the two of you is that, to me, I think that pigeonholing yourself into only doing one thing is it's not in my nature. And so I try and work with my students to get them to see that there is a broad spectrum of things that they could possibly do over their lifetime with the training, with the schooling that they're getting. And the only real limitation is when they tell themselves that they can't do something.
Interesting. And, you know, you and I we had a very interesting conversation, and you told me how you start your students off, and it's somewhat disruptive to many of them. Do you mind sharing that?
Yeah, absolutely. So we're, for the past, I don't know, I would say 10, 15 years, high schools have been engaged in a standardized testing as sort of the mode of kind of where they benchmark their student knowledge. And so every student in a cohort is taught to find the one answer, the thing that applies to that problem that all of them can get at the same time. And once they all get that same answer, they know they've gotten it right. But design is pretty much the opposite of that. There's not one finite answer. And so what that means is, since 2002, I've been teaching foundation design, whether it's in the art department or now in the School of Architecture. But that's that first day. The first day a student steps on campus, they've elected to want to get into art or design or graphic design or whatnot. And we have to sort of dial them back and re-teach them how to be creative thinkers. Teach them how to assess a problem, because that's really all that design is. Design is creative problem solving. There's going to be a set of issues that come in that you have to work within, and you've got to try and figure out what's the best way. And it's what's the best way to solve it. Is it the best way for you, the best way for your client, the best way for 100,000 people that you hope to market something to? But you have to be open to kind of investigating and finding those things. And so we look at foundation design, or I look at foundation design, as kind of stripping everything back, starting anew at kind of the basics of materiality, the basics of composition, of how things go together. And then as we build up over the months, over the years that the students are with us, things get a little more concrete, they get a little more real, and it that initial kind of creative foundation allows them to apply that problem solving in a way that is going to eventually get them their best result, as opposed to the maybe only pulling from the things that they've been around. If we were to tell a freshman student, okay, design a library, they're going to design the libraries that they've been in. They're not going to design the best library that they possibly could. And so we want them to get to the point where no matter what the space is they're looking at, no matter who the person is they're looking at designing for, they have that ability to think creatively, to find the solutions, to test a bunch of things, and then kind of hone in to find that.
That's interesting. So, you know, we always hear, especially in, let's say, the past, I don't know, 10 or 15 years, that what do they call it, critical thinking. There are a lot of people coming out of primary and university-level education, and they're not always great at critical thinking. But it sounds like you're not even pushing for critical thinking. This is beyond critical thinking. You're asking people to think even beyond themselves and whatever they consider reality. Like your example with the library, if you've been to the library, you know what a library looks like, and so you design things based on what you already know. So in a way, and I'm going to say it the way I'm hearing it and thinking it. In some ways, you're asking people to design things in a way that they don't even know they don't know. Is that a good way to put it? You're still there, Stephen?
Hi, Stephen. Okay, we've got a bad connection going on here. And I'm not sure what's going on. And Lori has stepped away, and I'm unable to control this. So, Stephen, if you can speak, that would be great. Not sure if you can hear me. I thought it was my headset. I took it off. And now I'm directly into the phone. Very interesting. So it seems as though Stephen is talking about more creative, training people to think what we call creative thinking, innovation. And you know, you hear so often about breakthroughs being in this domain of things that you didn't know that you didn't know, not improving what's there. Sort of like you were saying that you could design a library and maybe make it better than you know a library to be. And perhaps your job as a designer requires you to design a library that hasn't existed before. And it, aside from knowing that it's a library, that may be very difficult. And it sounds like you're trying to come back in, Stephen. I'm not sure if it's your signal has dropped. So if we're talking about being creative, that's a different kind of thinking than, let's say, if you're doing accounting where you can get the right answer, you know, debits and credits and assets and liabilities and revenue, owner's equity. There are so many things, you know, you can understand about assets and liabilities and debits and credits, and the answer has to be correct if you're going to balance the books and give an accurate report on the financial health of a company. If you are designing, that's a very different paradigm. And as he was saying, it's not about giving the right answer. Like, we've been educated in the context of standardized tests where you are rewarded for giving the correct, the accurate answer based on what the book says and what you've been told. When you are in the design world, it sounds like there, in some cases, there is no answer. You're creating things that haven't existed in the past. I mean, how do you design a library that's never existed before? Or the interior of a car. You know, if we look at automobiles 100 years ago and what the interior of a car was, very different than now. And in 1920, I don't think they had windows yet. So here we are. We have all kinds of windows and doors that open up in interesting ways. So consoles, we can call from our dashboard. So cars are very different. And these are often the case of a designer who, as our late great Steve Jobs, someone asked him, "Hey, Steve, people are not accustomed to touching the screen of their phone for functionality, and he just said, "Oh, they'll get used to it." So that's, I guess, the job of a designer is, even when he's creating things that haven't existed before, it's not shying away, and people will adapt and address and sort of conform to a new way of doing things. Like now, it's very common to dial from your screen and touch your screen to see text messages and emails and swipe right and swipe left. We have all these things that didn't exist 25 years ago. So, and these are the things that designers do to change our lives, make them more convenient. And that takes a different kind of thinking. If you want your finances, or you want an engineer building a bridge, you want it to be very accurate. You want that bridge to function exactly what you want it for. You know, be able to handle tons and tons of trucks and cars driving across. Here we have the George Washington Bridge coming over, connecting us from New Jersey to New York. And as creative as it may be, you still need the engineers to have mathematical precision. And it sounds like the design world isn't doing that. So what we are, and if we can get Stephen back, what we are really here to talk about is how do you inspire and motivate and train? How do you help people think in such a way that they're not limited to their own personal experience, like their own world, to make sense? So if you only have your world as reality and what you've been exposed to, and you design based on what you've already seen, there may be so many limits. Like, would we ever have invented flying? You know, that's a great example of innovation. You know, how many innovative ways did they attempt to fly? So if you're designing someone's home or an office, that same sort of creative innovation is absolutely essential. And since we all were born into a specific environment, and that environment informs us of what's possible, what's impossible, and that's our reality, right? So with the Wright brothers, the belief was if man were meant to fly, he would have wings. So I think there were people who actually attempted to fly back then in early 1900s by creating wings for humans, and I don't think it went too well. So if the commitment is to get students to be innovative, what can we learn in the business world from the academic world that is literally training people to go into the business world and bring these innovative perspectives? And, you know, you have to wonder also, you know, you go into a world of business where precision and, you know, you have Six Sigma where you want to get rid of imperfections in the product, any widgets you're making. And so everything is like this scientific, precise, you know, timing. Everything has to be just right. And then you marry that with the world of design. And if you bring them into the design people into the architectural world, that could be a clash. I just wonder how that works. Because we're telling people to be creative as long as you color within the lines. And then we hear Stephen saying, well, you can color outside the lines. At least that's the impression I'm getting. Because if you're going to create things on the basis of things you didn't know, that could be challenging for people who are only operating based on what they do know. I mean, if you think about it, right? So how do we understand things we didn't know we didn't know? So there are lots of things that we know, right? So anyone who's listening, we could say it's fair to say you know English, and maybe we could say you know addition and subtraction and mathematics. And you know those things. You know how to add, subtract, you know how to speak English. And then we could say there's this whole domain of things that you don't know, and you know you don't know. So maybe you don't speak Mandarin, and you know you don't speak Mandarin. Except if you want to speak Mandarin, there are resources, there are universities, there are all kinds of products out there, tutors, that will allow you to learn Mandarin. Or you can go to China and learn it. So there, even though you know you don't speak Mandarin, you're not restricted for you're not restricted by that forever. You could gain access to learning that which you don't know. So you don't know it, there's a way to, there's a place to go to learn it, and you know you don't know it. So those are two domains. There's the domain of things that you know them, like speaking English. And then there's the domain of things you don't know, and you know you don't know them, like specific languages. And for some people, maybe it's calculus. You don't know calculus, and you know you don't know it. And then there's this whole domain of things you didn't know you didn't know, and you didn't even know you didn't know them. And that's a very different domain. So where do you go to develop this whole domain of things you didn't know you didn't know, and you didn't even know you didn't know it? Like, it's very difficult to get there based on what you already know. So there may be a language that you didn't know about. Like Hmong, M-U-N-G, it's spoken in Lao. So some people may have not even known they didn't know that. And without me saying it, how do you even understand that you didn't know that? But there are other things that you didn't know. And it's very difficult to give an example of something you didn't know you didn't know. You can give examples of what you know. You can give examples of what you don't know and you know you don't know. But for the things you don't know, you don't know. And so it sounds like Stephen is helping people make a leap into that paradigm of being able to think that which you didn't know you didn't know, and then create a whole world, design an entire world from that perspective. And I would say many corporations want access to that. And, you know, the challenge, as I alluded to before, is you have a corporation that's set up with all kinds of systems and metrics and processes, all based on things we know. And then there are some things that we don't know within the organization, except we know we don't know them, and we can get access. We can hire people. We can hire consultants. You know, we can figure, you can work those things out. But the innovative side of corporations relies on the things you didn't know you didn't know. And bringing those two worlds, like people who live in the domain of, well, I know how to do this, and I'm great. I'm an accountant. I'm an engineer. I'm a process improvement, and I know what I'm doing, and I know the rules of engagement for this. And now you bring this design person in who's been trained to think in that domain of didn't know you didn't know. And that could be a bit of a clash, because the people who know what they're doing may have already presupposed what can and cannot be done. So I would assume that makes it a bit more challenging when you're training people to think from that, because they are also bringing, you know, we've been educated to standardize tests to say, well, I know this. I know 1 + 1 = 2. And you're asking me to make 1, 1 and 1, some other number. 1 + 1 = 3a. × 2. Mathematicians may find that easy. In mathematics, there's a level of creativity to that also, especially when you get to the PhD level. But training people to think that which is unthought, that which they've never thought before. Are you back, Stephen?
Steven?
Oh.
Steven, yeah. There?
No,
he's on.
No. Yep.
Steven?
For some reason,
I'm here.
No, listen. Steven.
Oh, he's here.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm not sure what happened. Were you able to hear me all that time?
Yeah, I've been trying to call back. I've been calling back in.
Okay,
so,
that's
yeah,
why.
I've heard a lot of it, but yeah.
Okay, that's what happened. He called back in, and I couldn't let him back in. That's why.
Okay.
So he could hear everything.
Got him.
So, Stephen, I was Did you hear the question I asked you?
I think so.
20 minutes ago?
I think I've caught it a few times. But I think one of the things, I have two quotes, or I have actually a word that we talked about, and then a specific quote that I always like to use with my students. I'll do the quote first. And it's from an Italian architect and furniture designer and product designer. And the quote says, "Look at usual things with unusual eyes." And so when I tell my students that, it's to not approach the world, not approach the things around them in an expected way, in a jaded way, in taking things for granted. It's looking at the things around them as through the lens of everything in the world that we interact with on a daily basis has been designed by someone. And it's been designed specifically for a reason by someone. And so the phone that I'm on right now, the computer that some people are on, the chairs that you're sitting at, the car that you may be driving in, all of those things were designed with everything for a specific reason. And so in telling students to come to usual things with unusual eyes, it allows them to kind of contemplate those ideas of what could be next. What's the thing that I need to have happen? What's the space I need to have happen? So many people over this past year have had to make the switch to online learning at home. And I know myself personally, I've built two work at home, study at home desks for my kids. And so that was a thing that I just had to make that switch and say, okay, I got to spend a weekend, got to do these things. It has to do these specific kind of uses that my middle school daughter is going to need and my high school son is going to need. And so those moments, you're not going to necessarily make the thing that you've seen, but you have to be able to say, okay, what's going to be the next thing that's going to allow my son, my daughter to maximize their potential. And so, yeah, you're coming at it with those unusual eyes. And the word that we talked about, Ted, that I enjoy kind of putting out to my students, it's an old English word. It's called cattywampus. And the definition of cattywampus is to travel in a purposeful manner towards a vague destination. And so it's to know that you're trying to accomplish something, but being able to understand that there may be a left turn at some place, there may be something that arises at a certain point that you have to kind of deal with, because those issues are what leads to the next thing. So it's kind of always moving in that purposeful direction, but being able to say, okay, yeah, there are other things that may come out during that process.
I love that word. I've never heard it before. And it's funny because Ted and I, you know, had met through Landmark, which kind of gives you that same perspective. It's like, you know, never judge, always look at it with fresh eyes. Don't have preconceived notions, you know, look at it from more of an objective standpoint. And, you know, you have to kind of, you know, look at things very differently and kind of roll with it, per se, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
Cattywampus. I like
yep,
that. Thank you for a new word today.
Yeah, it's one of those fun things you just throw in. Absolutely.
Definitely fun things. So,
One of the things I was saying was that there are things that we know, and Stephen was saying that we are, you know, high school, up to high school, we are educated to, we're trained to understand knowledge based on standardized tests. So you have to have like the right answer, the exact answer.
Right.
Those are things that we learned and we know. And then there are things that we don't know. Like, so if you don't know how to speak Mandarin, you don't know it, and you know that you don't know it. But then there's this whole domain of things you didn't know you didn't know, and you didn't even know you didn't know them. And it sounds like part of what Stephen is wants people to have access to that and be able to create an event from there. But there has to be a purpose. It's not just sort of airy-fairy and anything goes. It's a cattywampus aspect to it also.
There's an element, especially early on, of play and of being willing to just try things. And so what we try and do in the first year is give the students the confidence to be able to play, to not have to worry about kind of that finite thing. So we're not designing a very specific thing. And then as they kind of get used to using materials, get used to scale, get used to certain things, then that's when we start to add in those elements slowly. So by the time they finish with 4 years, 5 years, they will have worked at lots of various different scales and at various different kind of purposes. So 1 year they may be actually working with a real estate developer and being very specific and kind of working on an existing project and kind of throwing out new ideas. Another project might just be, I know we just finished up a project with our second years where the first thing that they analyzed was an opening passage of Alice in Wonderland. And so they had to design the rabbit hole that Alice was falling down. And then they took those kind of playful elements and then they embedded them within a real site. And so it's taking the ethereal and putting it into the corporeal that I think allows the students to be able to kind of be more free and sort of understand the potentials of what they can do rather than just saying, okay, these are the only things I can do.
Very interesting. They did that very well at the Cosmopolitan Hotel in Vegas, and they took that whole Alice in Wonderland theme and made like the most amazing like dining area where they have a whole different food court, and it's the whole teacup kind of down the rabbit hole idea. It's so well done. So the fact that you take that and do that same thing is amazing as well. One of the things that I really noted that you do so well is engaging your students in your teachings or in your enthusiasm. And I'm wondering how you do that so well, right? Because as employers or as teachers or as even as parents, you know, we want to engage our students, our kids, our employees in what we believe.
Right.
And we all want to know that magic secret.
I think it's different for everybody as far as how you approach it. Because I think that to go into education, everyone has their story behind what kind of brings them there. And that's what's really nice about, like, being part of a multi-year kind of level institution where it's the students are going to get exposed to several different people's ways of working or ways of inspiring. And so some are more direct and some are more kind of abstract, and some you wouldn't even know they want to inspire you. They want you to kind of find everything on your own. So for me personally, I can only work the way that I can. I've always approached teaching as almost coaching. Sports was always big to me when I was growing up, and I've coached high school sports. I've coached my son's teams and things like that. And so you're approaching and looking at each individual student and maximizing their potential. You're not looking at saying I'm creating 16 of the same person. I'm finding the things that each student has, trying to maximize those. And then during the time, it's trying to create opportunities. right now there's a large kind of push for high impact practices within education, coming up with very specific ways to engage a student beyond just reading from the book and being able to answer the question. With the design education, we do a lot of those impact practices to begin with. And so now we've got to figure out, okay, how do we come up with higher impact practices? And so that's mm-hmm. like where Lori and I met. I bring my students down to High Point Market twice a year. I run outside of teaching. I run a nonprofit that runs design challenges for different universities around the country. So I try and create these opportunities. If a student wants to do them, that's great. If they don't, that's fine. But I want to be able to put these things in front of them and let the ones who decide, okay, this is what I want to do. This is the type of student I want to be. This is the kind of engagement I want to have. Let them be able to kind of decide where they want to run with it. I think if I have just as much to learn from my students as I think they do from me, and so when I can create these things and I see the way that students interact with them, that helps me to learn, okay, what do I need to do? What do I need to try next? How do I need to manipulate this? How do my students deal with it differently than the students from Auburn or the students from University of Minnesota or whatnot, and what does that mean as a larger picture? So there's just a lot of things that go into it, but it's just kind of trying to create as many opportunities for students to kind of broaden their exposure to kind of let them start to craft and create what their educational experience is really going to be.
Yeah, it's so amazing. I mean, maybe that's just one way for businesses to innovate their employees is to give them challenges with, you know, extra bonuses. Like, hey, you know, we have this challenge or who's winning. And you see a lot of employees do that on the board. Oh, this is employee of the month or employee of the week. Or, you know, this employee has so many reviews, so we're going to give them a $100 bonus. Or, you know, commission-based, right? So, and that's what you're saying, essentially, you do is you create these opportunities where they either, you know, can take them, right? It's not a mandate, but it's a choice, and, you know, those people who want it, it's there for them.
Right.
It's really cool. You just do it in such a nice way.
Well,
you know, like, because I had the opportunity of seeing you with your students, and it was just the way that you enroll them and the way you speak to them and engage that it's, you know, it's not like, oh, here's a contest and you're going to succeed. It's kind of like, oh, like you said, you present the opportunity as opposed to presenting a contest or something like that.
Right, right. And so when I got involved with the organization I'm in right now, it's called University Hall of Innovation and sort of the umbrella nonprofit. Someone else was running it. Someone else was kind of managing that part, and I started just as a faculty leading a group of students. And I had kind of connected really well with the president who was working with it at that time. And over time, he decided that he was going to close his business, and it had been such an embedded thing in the furniture industry in High Point Market for several years that I decided, okay, I'm going to pick it up and I'm going to run with it. It's one of those things where, okay, I've got a full-time job, but now I'm going to throw this on top of all of it just because I think it still has a lot of validity. And so when I picked that up, I wanted to look at, okay, how can we take this to the next place? Originally, it was dealing with a single manufacturer. And we said, I wanted to say, how can I make this a more general sort of thing that anybody in any kind of section of the country would be able to do this? And so we turned it into a single sheet plywood competition that students can sort of easily access the material. They can kind of play with it in different ways. They don't need to kind of be very specific with only working towards one goal. And then from there, we keep on adding more and more to it and trying to figure out, okay, how do we take the next thing? And so we do models that the students design that throughout that process, we try and connect them with industry professionals that can help to mentor them along the way as they're designing. So it's giving them the information that maybe they don't have access to in their classrooms, because there's only so much that we as faculty can have the time to teach. And so we want to use industry as much as possible. So if I bring in a furniture designer who's been doing it for 20 years that can talk to manufacturing costs or shipping costs or what happens if we make it 2 inches more narrow to where we can flat pack it into this standard box or those kind of things, that can allow the students to then kind of access that level of thinking about their design. That's the perfect thing for me, as opposed to a competition where it's, okay, you just kind of send your final product in and then whatever happens, happens. I want to try and figure out ways to let industry connect with the students, let students connect with the industry more.
That makes sense. They better understand the business of their business.
Right.
So and maybe you answered this already. Just want to kind of go back to where you started in the beginning. I mean, if you're asking students to step outside of the way they've been trained to think, to analyze information, and produce based on the information they have. Do you get resistance when you're telling them to cottywaffle? I mean, do students get frustrated about that? Because, you know, this is not the way I was trained to think in school.
Absolutely. They do. And so there's probably about 60-40 of students who will either just get super frustrated early on, and we have to keep on reminding them just to say, okay, yes, this is frustrating right now, but there will come a time when it's going to make sense, and it's going to allow you to kind of work to the next place. And there's other students who are just like, all right, I'm going to trust you. I don't understand what I'm doing, but I'm going to keep on going. And we try and explain to them that there are no real failures. If you make a thing and it doesn't work as good as it can, that's not a failure. The only failure is to stop at that point, is to not
Right.
try and figure out how to make it better, not try to figure out how to make it more successful. And so usually what happens is some point within a 15-week semester, when we reach about, I would say, week 10 or so, some students start, like, light bulbs start going off, and they're like, okay, wait, now I kind of understand. Because we reach a point where at midterm we'll have them pin up everything that they've done in the beginning of the semester. And so they've been working really hard, but never looking at them as the accumulation of work, looking at at that point, just looking at them as, okay, I finished this one thing, and then I finished this other thing. And so once they pin everything up and they can see kind of how things connect, and they can understand and maybe start to trust us that it's like, okay, yeah, we are leading them in that vague direction, but we're not leading them off of the cliff. We're leading them to a thing. And so if we can let the students know that everybody's going to get there, they may get there at a different time. And it's not all about kind of understanding things in the moment. It may take some people 3 months to understand kind of how things are working. It may take people 2 years into the program to understand exactly how things are working. Some people may get it from the beginning, but as long as the students are willing to progress with us in that vague direction, I think we get them to the place they need to be.
And do you think that's analogous? You know, companies talk about transforming corporate culture, or they start making products. I mean, I can only imagine for, let's say, Apple Computer. They made these, you know, large computers that were loved by the advertising agencies. And now they're going to make these little tiny iPods. Like, you know, even though they're computers and it's, there are lots of skills that are transferable, initially it may not have made sense. It may have been frustrating. And, you know, a lot of people don't know that Steve Jobs actually introduced the, I think it was called the Newton, which looks like the iPad. That was 1983. It failed. So I can imagine how frustrating it would have been in the early 80s. And, you know, most people don't have a in 1983, most people didn't have a computer in their office on their desk. Surely most didn't have it in their home. And now here's this guy talking about, oh, yeah, it's this little device that you can hold in the palm of your hand. It's a computer. And people didn't get it. So it must have been frustrating. So it sounds like you're kind of working with people that way so that they can go into the business world and be more nimble and creative.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And so on that same point, there was a sort of the father of American industrial design. He was a French-born kind of guy who came and did a lot of work in America. He did the Exxon sign. He did kind of the U.S. Postal Service logo. His name is Raymond Loewy. And he was against just kind of redesigning things just to have yearly models so that you could have more profit. He followed a motto that was called Maya. It was M-A-Y-A, and it was most advanced yet acceptable. And it's basically saying, okay, we're going to update when we have new materials or new technology, but we always have to think about, okay, what is the public ready for? What are they going to be willing to kind of change in their daily lives in order to get this? Because if we throw everything at them,
right,
is something that could change the world going to fail because people aren't ready for it? And so, yeah, we want to create the students who will try. So we deal with iteration a lot. And so we will have one project that may take 2 or 3 weeks that every time we meet the students, so we meet them twice a week, they may have a different iteration. They may have a different version of it. And we try and tell them, okay, every iteration needs to be different enough that you can weigh them off of each other and say, okay, what are the pluses and minuses? So at the end, your final product may be an amalgamation of a bit of iteration one plus a little bit of iteration four with a one piece of iteration two, but we want them to be able to try like the full gamut and then be able to pull it in and find exactly what it needs.
Interesting. So and so what I think would be, and you may have answered this already also, what I think would be interesting, especially to entrepreneurs and executives, how do you motivate or inspire, if those are even the right words? Like, ultimately, you're helping people make a leap. You know, like you said, some people get it right from the beginning, and then other people may take 2 years. So you're asking them to take a leap. You know, you've been educated this way. We're educating you in a way you have never been educated before, and we're asking you to trust us and go along with it, right? So how do you stop a mutiny and people saying, look, you're wrong. This is how it goes, man. We're not doing your way. We're going to do it, you know, the old-fashioned way. Like, how do you get people to make that leap?
It's tough to meet that resistance. I think as long as it doesn't become a my way or the highway kind of thing,
right,
Everyone ends up close to the same place. I think as a teacher, the way that I look at it is if I start a class at the beginning of a semester. All right, so we just finished our fall semester. I'm planning for our spring semester, and I'm making a timeline. I'm making a set of projects, a set of kind of expectations. if I only approach that as saying, if I don't meet this entire timeline and all these expectations exactly as I've written them out, it's a failure. That's what I think is the kind of being too unwieldy. If you're willing to every day kind of reassess the situation and start to say, okay, what's happening? What are the students getting? What do they need? What's the next way that I need to explain, or do I need to come back, or do I need to take a step back and totally start over? I think as long as a faculty can acknowledge kind of what's happening within a group and be willing to kind of make some changes to the expectations, changes to the steps along the way, then I think that's when everyone will end up in that same place. Now, how that applies into the workforce, I mean, it's a lot harder because you're dealing with, I'm dealing with, is somebody going to get an A or a C, as opposed to saying, is someone kind of bottom line going to end up where they need it to, kind of thing. So it's tougher to be able to make some of those jumps, but within the design thinking process, all right, so there's a layout, a generally understood design thinking process that starts with empathy, starts with defining the problem at hand, starting to ideate ways to solve it, prototyping from there, but at every step you're reviewing, you're going back. So every time you go forward, you're still going back. And making sure that the next thing you've done is taking into consideration all the things you've just done. And so, yeah, it becomes this cycle of kind of making sure and testing and working through to see what your final product is, whether that's a tangible thing, whether that's an idea, whether it's the next kind of web-based algorithm. I mean, it's anything. It's always being willing to test it and making sure that at every step of the way, you're following and doing the things that you've kind of, the path that you've laid out.
Interesting. And so as a professor, you're very much in a leadership position, and it sounds like you're in a dance. Like, so there's some responsibility that you're taking and saying, well, you're not saying, well, it's on you, students, and if you don't get it, that's your problem. I'm just going to, you know, drag you along. You're reassessing yourself in more effective ways to communicate, and you're also getting where people are. Like, you understand where they are and being responsible for that. So there's no sort of beating them over the head, which I think is great. That's excellent. I also wonder... So after they go through your training, they've spent a number of years in your program, and they go into corporate America where, you know, there's this exactness, you know, people have been educated to standardize tests still, you know, engineers, accountants, Six Sigma people, and your people are coming in talking about a cottywaffle. So that your students, when they go into the business world, they come back to the other side of the coin. So now they've gone through this cottywopple, and now they're in corporate America, who may not get their sort of design thinking. Have you heard much from students like that? That becomes frustrating, that they're being asked to stay within the lines too much?
I think in some ways, we have heard it from certain students. It all depends on where they end up. Okay. Our students have gone into vastly different areas of the country, different kind of sections of the business world, of the design world. And so, yeah, some people may have to figure out, okay, what parts do I leave behind? What parts do I try and introduce into the business? How do I help to kind of explain to them design thinking? But what's actually really beautiful right now is that architecture students, interior architecture students, kind of product design students, those kind of things, they're being sought after by a lot of segments of the business world because of this design thinking process.
Exactly.
Because
right.
it's what certain people might be missing. Yeah.
Yeah, I can easily see that. I was reading a couple of years ago how a lot of executives in corporate America are hiring people with liberal arts education because they have a more expanded view of the world. So they are looking for people who can think that way. So that's the other side when people really appreciate the way they think, like they're sort of in heaven. They get to, you know, write their own ticket in some ways. So
absolutely.
Very interesting. So we're closing in on the end of the show. Any final words of advice based on everything you've said and what you've seen as a professor?
I think it's just going to be reiterating. It's just going to be being open and being willing to understand the things that you don't know, the things that make you feel uncomfortable, and being able to assess, okay, is this something that I want to tackle? Do I want to push forward? Do I want to try something different? Am I willing to make this jump? And if you're not willing to make that jump, maybe the next one is the one you're willing to make. But just being open to the potentials and possibilities of what is going to come up at any time, whether it's an opportunity that someone else sees something in you, letting you know, okay, yeah, no, I really enjoy the way that you presented something. I think you should I think you could really work with us really well with this. Or the individual person saying, I like what they're doing. I think I could have fun experimenting with that. So yeah, just being open to the possibilities of not defining what you can't do, but being open to kind of exploring the things that you can possibly do.
Good. And if anyone's interested in your program, how do they get a hold of you? Do you have contact information?
Sure. Yeah, we do. So the overall umbrella is the University Hall of Innovation. And so the website is universityhallofinnovation.com. And then we have the webcast that the students, it's called the Students Perspective, that's through there where my students interview industry professionals. That's where we interviewed Lori at High Point Market. We got back to be live, which was great. But we've been able to connect with some of the largest kind of manufacturers and designers down to even the kind of smallest students and recent grads and things. And so we want students to understand that there's a lot of different potentials within the industry. And so each one of these shows becomes almost a mini lecture series that students can kind of find a new thing that might kind of interest them. And that's called A Student's Perspective. And that's at www.astudentsperspective.tv. And you can find all of our past seasons. We're just wrapping up season 5 next week, and then we'll be starting season 6 coming up in January, and that'll be Lori's interview will be in season 6.
Very cool. Thank you so much for being our guest and being receptive, and it was really great having you.
Absolutely. Thank you very much. I'm glad we were able to work, and I'm glad we got the tech to work and everything else. But I totally understand that because
sorry about that.
Our first couple interviews we ever did virtually, it involved me holding the cell phone up to a camera, and then our student. Yeah, it was bad. I totally get the tech issue.
Okay. Well, appreciate your patience.
Sometimes it just kicks in.
Yep.
Not sure what happened, but anyway, it all worked out in the end. So appreciate you sharing so openly. So thank you very much.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
All right.
All right.
Have a great
Bye-bye.
Evening, everyone. Take care.
Bye.
Good night.
See you next week, everyone. Bye-bye.
Thank you.